The federal government spends $6.5 million annually protecting migratory wildlife. This year, Congress failed to appropriate $3.5 million to educate migratory children. Senator Harrison Williams, chairman of the Subcommittee on Migratory Labor, was asked if state or federal legislation was the answer.
Many aspects can only be successfully dealt with at a national level. For example, wages. We see states in competitive positions. They're reluctant to raise wages through legislation in their state because their farmers are competing with farmers in other states. And we see in education, some states who have taken great strides. We can't expect states to do it alone when they know their neighboring state with whom their farmers compete are not doing anything. We know that just about everybody in this country has some federal support for adequate housing through FHA or whatever the program is, except the farm community. And the migrant farmer is the most poorly housed member of our society.
Senator Williams, a Democrat, and Secretary of Labor Mitchell, a Republican, have called for legislation which will probably come before the next session of Congress. And only last week, President Eisenhower made the Presidential Committee on Migrants a permanent body. But the real problem is that there are many kinds of farmers and many kinds of crops. The big mechanized grain and dairy farmers use little or no migrant labor. Some of the major canneries do pay fair wages and provide adequate housing. However, it must be stated that most of the fruit and vegetable farmers find it economically impossible to build good housing like this to be used only 6 weeks a year. The farmer claims he is trapped between what society expects and his market demands. Howard Jones, a grower in Florida, was asked if he knew what his beans, picked that day, would bring in the market.
Well, you can't tell from one day to another. Some days you'll go down there and you'll get $5, and I've seen them drop to $1.50 the next day. One day there'll be $3, the next day there might be $2, or one day there'll be $2, and the next day there could be $4.
Who sets your price?
Well, that's what we're all trying to figure out. Everybody, I don't know the answer, but the chains seem to have more to do with setting the prices than anyone else. There's too much difference between the price that they're paying the farmers all over the country. And we thought about trying to get somebody to investigate it, some of the congressmen, the senators, but you go up there to Washington, we had a group of boys go up there here a couple of years ago. They gave them a runaround. Agriculture Department, they all give them a runaround. We believe that those chains have lobbyists in Washington, and they're going to do pretty well as what they please.
Mr. Mitchell, some of the growers have told us that the chain stores fix the prices, and they cannot meet those prices if they pay their labor a higher wage. What about that?
Well, I wonder if that's a very valid argument. That might be said of many other industries. It might be said, for example, of the garment industry, and I've heard it alleged that retailers dictate to the manufacturer the price they will pay for a garment. And in effect say, you produce the garment at that price, no matter what it takes to produce it. However, the garment worker in this country fares very well in terms of standard of living, due in large measure to the efforts of people like Mr. Potofsky and Mr. Davinsky of the ILGWU and the Amalgamated Clothing Workers and others who have taken what was a very substandard industry this not so long ago, 1911, the Great Fire in New York. Today, these workers are thriving members of the community. And the price that my wife pays for a garment today, she gets a much better garment than her mother ever had at a lower price. So this argument that the farmer has to meet the dictation of the chain store leaves me rather cold.
world looks to Wall Street for good investments, so we brought one here to show you. The Buick LeSabre. It's the old buy low, sell high idea. It's a full-size car with a 350 cubic inch V8 engine, automatic transmission, power steering, and power front disc brakes, all standard. There are dividends available, like a vinyl roof, steel road wheels, white wall tires, and an AM radio. The manufacturer's suggested retail price is $44,5205. And even though that doesn't include state and local taxes and dealer destination charges, it sure is buying low. The selling high is in LeSabre's great resale value. Invest in one soon at your Buick dealer.
Ted and I just can't seem to get together. So I got this. $40 an ounce. Nice. But don't forget the close-up.
I used to, thanks.
I'll buy a wig, too.
Gail, put your money where your mouth is. Whiter teeth and fresh breath will bring Ted closer.
This red stuff will whiten my teeth? Makes my teeth their whitest. It has a real mouthwash. Try it.
Hey, did you get together last night?
Did we ever?
Put your money where your mouth is. Buy close-up.
Why, Morris? Where were you? I was so worried.
Good. Always keep owners guessing.
How about some din-din?
Act finicky, too. Stroll by the old dish-a-roo without even...
Some nine lives, dear?
Uh-oh.
Tuna, livers...
Super supper. Chicken and fish.
Nine lives. Nutritious foods cats really like. Even Morris.
I'll be finicky tomorrow.
The migrant farm worker occupies the lowest level of any major group in the American economy. The soil has produced no Samuel Gompers or John L. Lewis. As Secretary of Labor Mitchell states,
I think the AFL-CIO in the past has been too preoccupied with other affairs, and probably the farm problem was so tough that they were reluctant to tackle it. I think their attitude and policy has changed, and they're making a greater effort now to organize than they ever have in the past.
Farm labor, however, is excluded from all federal legislation designed to protect the rights of those engaged in interstate commerce to organize and bargain collectively. In 1959, the AFL-CIO set aside $100,000 in an effort to organize the fruit pickers of California. One of the large growers in California was asked what he thought of this effort to organize the fruit pickers.
I think their very lack of progress and their very lack of success in signing up members has shown that the industrial type of union which they represent has no place or application to agriculture.
Charles Schumann, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, was asked how his organization felt about unions.
I think that the agricultural worker needs to have the right to change jobs, freedom to move about, freedom to quit if he doesn't like it, freedom to protest, freedom to negotiate where they are organized, but the right to strike at the time of harvest ought to be regulated in some manner.
The AFL-CIO Organizing Committee in California thinks differently. Earlier this year, they called a strike meeting of cherry pickers in Stockton.
He's on the go. Nora will stake him summer, and the pay has been too low.
A meeting reminiscent of the days of Otto and Steele organizing in the 30s.
We'll stand as one or fail. Keep your hand upon the dollar. And the dime for every pail.
Louis Cranach, an official of the organizing committee.
Your negotiating committee met with cherry industry representatives for the first time in the history of agriculture. They set a minimum of 110 per 16-quart bucket for good and average picking. Now, some contractors and growers will try to beat down that minimum price. They'll say that they can't afford to pay 110 a bucket for the big crop. that they're squeezed, that the Chrysler Imperial needs fixing, or Junior's Thunderbird is on the blink. Now, it's up to you and the rest of the pickers. It's your program. It represents united action.
Sure, you can get a job, but if you can't live on what you make, what good is the job?
You make $5 or $10 today, and tomorrow you just looking for a job and stay on the street, looking for a job. Now, you don't got no job another day. What do the local people wish to do?
We live anywhere. In a tent, under a shade tree, under a river bridge. We drink water out of a creek or anywhere we can get it. 5 or 6 families drink out of one cup, a tin can, or anything else. We're vain. We tolerate that stuff. If we stick together and say we won't do it, we won't pick your chairs until you give us some restrooms in the field for the ladies, some for the men, and some water fit to drink, you won't pick them. We get them.
The fruits of the earth must be harvested to feed and sustain mankind.
What have you to show for picking? Since the harvest has begun, we have barely made expenses, but we've set a going scale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and a dime for every pail.
The question posed by thoughtful men is, must the 2 to 3 million migrants who help feed their fellow Americans work, travel, and live under conditions that wrong the dignity of man? Secretary of Labor James Mitchell says,
I feel sad. I feel sad because I think that it's a blot on my conscience as well as the conscience of all of us who are whom society has treated a little more favorably than these people. They have no voice in the legislative halls. They certainly have no voice in Congress. And their employers do have a voice. Their employers are highly organized and make their wants and terms and conditions known to our legislators. I know of no greater pressure lobby, so-called, in Washington than the farm group. In all the matters in which I am interested in, I have been frustrated to a greater extent than in any other sphere of activity as Secretary of Labor in my inability to make any impact at all in terms of either regulations or law that would help the farm workers. And the pressures of the farm groups are tremendous. We guarantee to the farmer no loss in certain crops. There the farmer likes to participate in the government largesse. But Lord help the fellow like myself who dares suggest that perhaps the government should do something about the workers that work on farms. It seems to me that in our kind of a country, we no longer quarrel with the idea that man is worthy of his hire, a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. After all, the employers of this country, as indeed the workers, are part of our way of life. And it's morally wrong, it seems to me, for any man, any employer, to exploit his workers. In this day and age, I don't think we should tolerate it. As a citizen, in or out of this office, I propose to continue to raise my voice until the country recognizes that it has an obligation to do something for them.
And while men of goodwill seek to right injustice, the migrant, the lonely wanderer, the outcast is trapped in the stream. Now it is November, the last of the laborers, in trucks, buses, and cars, approach the southern states to start the cycle all over again. The Sunshine State welcomes them back. Homestead, Immokalee, Pahokee, Belglade, and hundreds of other communities. This is home. New housing is available. The rent, $15 per room per week. The migrant is at the mercy of the weather. This year in Florida, there was a freeze, killing beans, tomatoes, celery, corn. Its byproduct was a breadline. Migratory farm workers are not eligible for unemployment insurance. This happened in the United States in 1960. A line of humans waiting for a ration of tinned goods, milk, and bread. The Secretary of Labor says, for the rest of my life, in or out of office, I propose to do something for them. Migrants are back in Belglade, winter quarters, after months of travel and work. One said he brought back $1.65, another said $6. Another said we broke even. We were broke when we left, broke when we got back. We asked them what they thought they could do to help themselves, and they said nothing. What can we do? Last week, a presidential committee made up of the Secretaries of Labor, Agriculture, Interior, and Health, Welfare, and Education made certain recommendations regarding the migrants. Here are some of them. Extend child labor laws to cover agricultural workers. Eliminate residence requirements so that migrants will be eligible for health, education, and welfare programs. A federal law requiring crew leaders to register, thus protecting migrants from exploitation. Extension of workmen's compensation laws to agriculture. New housing regulations. States to pay local school boards for the education of migrant children. There will, of course, be opposition to these recommendations. Too much government interference. Too expensive. Socialism. Similar proposals have been made before. In fact, 150 different attempts have been made in Congress to do something about the plight of the migrants. All except one has failed. The migrants have no lobby. Only an enlightened, aroused, and perhaps angered public opinion can do anything about the migrants. The people you have seen have the strength to harvest your fruit and vegetables. They do not have the strength to influence legislation. Maybe we do. Good night. And good luck.
Fruits and vegetables. And God's people, the farm worker who picks it lives to 39 years, malnourished on his wages. And God's people, America, with 6% of the world's people, uses 60% of the world's annual consumption of raw material, wasting his riches in planned obsolescence in our ABMs and our MIRVs and our other instruments of war. God's people, Russia, can destroy God's people, America, 12 times. God's people, America, can destroy God's people, Russia, 40 times. We are, therefore, ahead. And then man's noise. 90 decibels of sound bombarding man's ear several hours a day will cause hearing loss. In New York City, ordinary street noises regularly exceed 100 decibels. The cost overrun on one torpedo, the Mach 48, exceeded federal spending in fiscal 1970 for elementary education, secondary education, and water pollution combined. And man saw that it was not all good. And on the seventh day, God rested from all the work that he'd done, and behold, he saw that all of it was very good. And man cannot rest from all the work that he has done, for behold, it is not all very good. Every little bit hurts. That is not true. All of it hurts. I do not know about you, but I'd like to be outside right now. I'd like to be standing in the meadow and catching my breath. This has been an ordeal just reading that garbage to you. This morning on the 6 o'clock news, as I came to the church, KCBS announced that the California poppy is nearly gone to the subdividers and that foundations and people are rallying to set aside some 2 or 3 reserves in the state so that we will have some remnants of our state flower. Last night, Joanne and I and the children returned from Lodestar, where there's a senior high camp this weekend. Yesterday morning, Joanne and I were walking in the manzanita grove above the meadow, wondering how the big truck got in there and made those big ruts across our meadow, a foot deep like a sword swath across someone's middle. And then our nose told us, and then we saw it. Someone has dumped a truckload of septic tank refuge in the middle of our manzanita. Quite frankly, the task you and I have is to keep from being overwhelmed. Believing that there is time, that there is ability enough, and money enough to reverse. To realize that we are facing a global issue, an international opportunity. I wish I could be more joyful. I really do. I would like to make you laugh today, but that's the way I believe the faith ought to be. I can't on this issue. And perhaps that's why we want to avoid issues, particularly in the church. Because there's so much pain in issues, there's so much truth. We'd like to have 1 hour apiece a week at least. But I'm making a plea this morning for me and for you and for all of us for an environmental ethic. And we're not talking about beer cans and gum wrappers. We're speaking of the quality of human existence. And that's the faith, folks. We're now at the base and the core. How will we live together in community? Without war, without smog, without fur coats, without racism, without spending the wad on the weekend. Perhaps without a shower a day. I'm not satisfied to have our experts say that they're earnestly seeking to find the tolerable levels that we can live in. That's an intolerable statement. For me, the Christian ethic seeks to make possible fullness of life, not possible levels of tolerance. The Christian faith talks about safety and peace and life for every person, for every plant, for every creature. The Bible even has the mountains clapping their hands for God and rejoicing that they exist. They do not clap in West Virginia where they are strip mined down to their core. For God, even the boulder is precious. Dirt is life. In Deuteronomy, the author says, therefore choose life, that thou mayest live, thou and thy seed. And that's it. Choose life. Humanizing the earth. We are trustees of all of life. And that's great. And that's joyful if we're together in it. For instance, I discovered this week, which Priscilla Wheeler shared with me, which was nice. There's hardly one agricultural crop or one decorative plant which is not been adopted from its area of origin. From whole continents, finding compatible soil and climatic conditions. Because of man, rice and wheat and the potato and the tomato and countless other crops have become cosmopolitan. My wife works for an educational firm which just moved their headquarters to San Francisco, and it's been a moving process. And she told me that in the 6 floors of the building where all their offices are, the first thing that was unpacked, the first thing that people set up all over that place were plants. That doesn't happen 10 years ago. That's part of the yes to life with a plant that you relate to. Oranges. I was raised as a kid in the East. The specialty of Christmas time was to get an orange in your stocking because we didn't get oranges in the East. But the oranges didn't come from America. They originated in China. And now they're grown in every continent. They've been shared by somebody. Wine is produced everywhere. And it came from the European grape. Australian eucalyptus trees flourish on the California coast. African violets, that little purple thing which my mother grows in every place she can find, including the bathroom, began on that continent. And now brighten our day and brighten our life. And that's what it's all about, it's the sharing. And finally, we need to sometime talk about the cost. I read in some research this week that it will take at least $10 billion just to keep us even. To stay just where we are. Won't clean anything up, just to stay where we are. It'll take $200 billion in just our country, plus all the laws and each of us as a responsible steward, and our children and grandchildren, to finally get ahead of it and reverse it. I didn't believe that the American bison was once down to 18 after millions. You used to rent a rifle across in the trains going across the plains for a quarter and fire out the window and make bets on how many you could hit. But America got together on that with the 18 little bisons left, and now the herds are up in the thousands again. That's part of it. But we need to be supporting international efforts. Now, I know some of you in this room. I know where you work. Some of you are some of the decision makers about this land. All of us are in some way, but some of you are real decision makers. And your humanness is going to affect this world. And I honor that. And praise that, and have hope for that. We are an island, this world of ours. We have no place to go, and we've got to get it together. Remember Sam, in a few sermons back, talked about a forest fire. In the midst of a forest fire, the lion, the mountain lion, the rabbit, the deer, and the skunk, they all cling together on an island of safety, and there's no fighting or eating each other up. Now that's, in a way, what we need to be at. Emergency means being together. And our environment, I believe, is a precious community and not a commodity. The Old Testament lesson talks about the process of creation. It was intended to be good and to be enjoyed. But there were laws that were established that we must be in balance with. And the New Testament lesson, after we've gone through 2,000 years of history, talks about the renewed place. And it's a city. You know, the Bible begins in a garden and ends in a cosmopolitan city. And that's where we are, most of us. For a moment, I want you to fantasize with me. I don't know about you, but I work best with my eyes closed. I want you to think of yourself in a place that for you means loveliness and security. Think of that place. It could be a meadow, a riverbank of your youth. It could be the library of your home. It could be a street corner on the top of Blair. put yourself in a place of loveliness and security. And without being horrified, we capture the things that challenge that existence. And as you stand or sit or lie in that place, formulate in your soul, please, that action to which you would give your life to preserve it, to make it possible for another to enjoy. For they shall inherit the earth. When I had to learn the Beatitudes in the second grade of Sunday school, I never liked that one. I didn't think it was good for someone to be meek with that sissy. 25 years later, in seminary, I discovered the meaning of the word meek. It comes from the Arab countries, then into Greece.